Welcome to Cannabis Business Minds Podcast with your host, Simone Samaluka-Radzins. Join me where I'll take you inside the ins and outs of this brand new and exciting business called cannabis. Connect with me on Calligia.com and follow us on social media as well. And here's today's show.
Colors fly. So you Phoenix, can. Yeah, flaming bird, mythological creature.
Okay, and so that's where I want to get you on the show for like two things. To talk about Phoenix Tears.
Okay.
And to talk about Canada and legalization and what that does for IP.
Okay.
Because Luke, since we talked last, I've been working with so many entrepreneurs.
Right.
I had to hire you. Still haven't really figured out my IP myself.
It's true. I'm behind on my building too, but.
Yes. Oh, well, don't tell me that. Don't tell me that yet. But entrepreneurs don't like to talk to lawyers.
No, they don't.
And it's unfortunate. I'm an entrepreneur. I feel like, oh, shit, I got to talk to Luke. I got to tell him about my business. And I obviously help
Your
entrepreneurs.
Your business is going to go better, too, if you do.
It is.
Yeah, like, yeah. Keep going. Sorry.
Well, but it's so true because you're telling me, like, what about this for your podcast? What about this?
Right.
Talk to me quick before we even start about any of this. What is the biggest thing that these entrepreneurs like myself are just running into right now with IP?
Not understanding what it is broadly. And then being like, what are the IPs? And I'm like, so intellectual property, talking about it as the IPs is like, you're essentially at level one. You don't even understand that there are subsections of intellectual property that you have to be aware of. So having someone even, like I've seen some agreements come across my desk that are self-written where they're like, I'm just going to license my intellectual property. And I'm like, your copyright, is that a patent that you own? Is it a trade secret? And then being like, no, just my intellectual property. And being like, that is so broad that this is not a detailed contract. You're already setting yourself up to fail because you don't understand what you're offering to the other side to convey. So really having some semblance of what is this? That's like, that is the first big step. And I think that this is why I like teaching at Oaksterdam, because I believe education is a huge component, especially for just getting to the point where you can identify it. That's what I encourage my students for. I'm like, I don't think you should go out of here and be like sophisticated in this or know how to manipulate it. Just be able to identify it and then know when to ask for help. So that's one of the biggest things I'm seeing where people are showing up and being like, I think I own this, or I think this is something, and then I'm putting my patent on my branding, and I'm like, you're not even using the words correctly, that is a massive problem. And I don't expect anyone to innately know what intellectual property and the subsections are, but if you're not taking the steps to understand it, you're going to cause a lot of problems for yourself down the road. And if you're avoiding attorneys, you better be really good at doing self-discipline and research, because you can find a fair amount of information on the internet. I would never encourage anyone to make decisions based off of that, because you can find a lot of wrong information on the internet, but at least getting a broad overview of what are these things and does this relate to something that's part of my business is very real.
Well, and I mean, you have to bite the bullet. You have to invest in an attorney. In my opinion, I mean, like in the end, it's like, you know, as entrepreneurs, I think that we're just all trying to like make sales, make our vision happen. Right. And it's like, I mean, I'm a CPA. It's like the accounting, the legal, all the boring, quote unquote, boring stuff.
Yeah.
No entrepreneur wants to deal with, but it's like literally the most important aspect of the business.
That's the fundamentals. I use the correlative that if you don't have a foundation for your house, anything like any of the siding or the decorations that you want to put on it, which is usually the fun stuff for a business, it's just going to fall apart. It's a house of cards, or you don't really own it, or you're using it improperly, or someone else is going to step in and say it's actually theirs. Worst case scenario, we're seeing more of that. I think it pays to have a great team. And that's one of the big pieces of advice that I'm giving entrepreneurs right now in the cannabis space is a lot of people have gone, especially if they're from the old days, I'll say.
What does the old days mean for the listeners who are just listening to this? This is our first episode.
Pre-legalization. People who are pre-legalization, I think, had in some cases a very lone wolf mentality of this is what I'm doing. I'm right. It's my way. Or maybe they had it later on a collective or a cooperative, and they're like, still, you probably had somebody kind of calling the shots of like, this is how I see things. Now you need a team. There's no way you can do everything by yourself. The level of sophistication to run a business. I mean, I can consistently hit points where I'm like, I can't answer that question for you. That's outside of my scope of knowledge base. You want to go to this other type of attorney, or you want that kind of agreement written. I don't do that. You want somebody who actually knows, or even in my area, you need to know more about a patent. I don't do patent work. I refer all my patent work out.
Well, and even in the entrepreneurial world, it's like you need somebody to manage the operations. Somebody, I mean, like the team effort, I think that, I mean, it's taken me a while as an entrepreneur to realize like you can go far by yourself, but if you want to like really go far, like you have to have the dream team or a team that you can hopefully make the dream team.
Right. I mean, I know for myself, I'm throwing my own law firm and starting my own business. I've hit a point now where if I could figure out how to successfully employ an admin person or use more admin assistants, that would streamline, you know, it would convert hours that I'm doing management stuff and internal stuff to profitable hours.
Oh yeah.
Which that's huge. Yeah. And then all of a sudden starting to factor in, okay, well, what can I afford? So that's something that for being in year 4.5 or almost 5 now, I agree with you. I think that if you want to succeed, you can't do everything by yourself. One, you have a limited understanding. We all have our own skill sets. Mm-hmm. Trying to operate outside of your skill set, I think, can be a massive pitfall. And we only have so much energy and time in a day. Yeah. You know, we all have lives we have to live too, that you can't constantly just be focused on your business.
I know. Oh gosh, that's so true. Before I talk about IP, it's very easy to find an assistant. It's very hard to find a very good assistant. Have you noticed that was the issue? Like
that is
finding somebody
my
that can
biggest
do it. Like,
hesitation is especially I think for building your business from the ground up, not like delegating responsibility, being like, one, it's just going to get done. Two, it's going to get done in a way that I want. And three, I've been doing my own bookkeeping and record keeping for 4.5 years. So you need to do it this way or you're going to throw off my entire stride and I'm not hiring you to reinvent the wheel. I'm hiring you to do what I do.
Yes.
And trying to get people also, P.S., I'm only going to take so much time to train you because I need to make this profitable so I can pay you.
Yeah,
I think that's really hard. That's my, and I'm almost at this point willing to accept plateauing in a certain sense, so long as I can hopefully have clients that I really want to work with, a work-life balance where I can still go to Burning Man every year if I want to, which I will be going this year. Things like that I think are really important. But I do see if you want to scale for profitability, you need to do that. I mean, I think you can only do so much. And then the invert, I mean, you start either upping your hourly, which will price you out of probably working with some of the people you want to work with and make clients harder to find. Or, you try to just take on more clients and then you're like.
And then you burn out.
Then you burn out.
The cycle. And then you want to go to Burning Man. And then it's a repeat. So what do you think, I mean, you know, Canada legalization is about to happen and federal legalization for adult use is about to happen in September, right?
October 17th,
I believe.
I think so. Yeah.
This is a huge moment from a global perspective.
For the world,
Talk to us about why that is.
Because the first G7 country will have legal cannabis.
Yes.
And apparently accessing to banking, which allows you to do a lot more things. Or take on massive investing and do public offering and have businesses like Harborside get listed on the Canadian Stock Exchange or seeing an injection from an alcohol company of $3 billion. we don't have, we can do some of those things in the United States with the caveat that there is a potential presumption that you're violating the CSA, and you could have the federal government or now securities, the SEC get involved and have it get really ugly. So trying to be we have a developed cannabis industry now, especially just from, we'll go from California, that is so out of step with what the federal government is treating it like, that laugh so you don't cry, but it just doesn't make sense anymore. I mean, we are so disjointed. And I look at the Canadian rollout, and what I appreciate about it, obviously federal support is huge, but by having this slow rollout, they were still able to preserve their medical. I mean, every state for the most part that has implemented adult use has thrown out its medical at a certain point, or at least drastically cut it back. And we're only there because of the people who were part of that movement and the people who are sick and are using cannabis as medicine. And I think to jump ahead and then be like, well, that doesn't exist anymore, is a real shame. I think that especially after the federal government maybe does get on board and reschedules it to Schedule 2, now looking at it being like it's this outpriced pharmaceutical product where before it was in the hands of the people, granted there needed to be more research done into how it was being used or an effective way to use it or safe way to use it. But it's just so disjointed that we're coming at it from two ends instead of Canada, which is like, okay, very slowly, medical, we're going to have control over this. We acknowledge it's medicine, which not acknowledging it at this point is ludicrous. And then slowly adding on pieces. And in the United States, as we had states go, for the most part, we just tried to add all the pieces at once. And, here are extracts, here are edibles, here are storefronts, granted, California is a different story where it had a really slow rollout since 96. But seeing that support from the federal government in Canada really allows the pieces to be put on when it feels like they're working. And that's not, for talking to some Canadians, it's not a perfect system. I don't think we can see a perfect system for this.
We don't know what the perfect system is.
Right. And especially just for testing it. Right. So first in line, please test it out. Right.
Yeah. Like, let's just see.
Right.
Because we have no idea. Alcohol is not the way that we can even match this. It's not pharmaceuticals either.
No.
Like, we have no true trajectory to go off of with a legalization of cannabis around the world.
Right? Right. And understand, as a market that was already there, now trying to redefine it into a legal market, it's amazing to me to see how now this, even like doing the cannabis hemp, where it's like, oh, CBD or CBDs is some people call it.
CBDs.
Did you get your CBDs today?
I got the CBDs.
But trying to do an understanding and like dissecting one plant down into multiple definitions based on how it expresses itself, and then having different classes of legalization around one plant is, in my opinion, asinine at best, and for doing compliance and oversight, a nightmare at worst. Like, how do you trying to monitor an organically growing
organism?
It's just and being like, hey, so these look almost identical, but this one is a Schedule 1 narcotic and this one is allowed by an agriculture bill, and being like,
there's the same genetics. Do you think that this is going to push the conversation with Canada happening and the United States and this turbulent time just with the federal government, do you think that's going to push towards a faster legalization here?
Well, I think it has to, the United States has to pay attention, because I think this is unfortunate, but money usually dictates progress in many ways in the United States. And seeing that Canada is going to start doing exportation and trade, that is going to motivate the United States. I think we're going to see, and we're actually already seeing it in Oregon, more acquisition of businesses from Canada. And I think if the federal government would wake up to that, because I'm of the belief that after federal legalization occurs, probably 10 or 15 years down the line, some PhD student is going to write an amazing investigative thesis on how we sold out one of the most unique agricultural opportunities of American history because we prolonged legalization so much. And looking at what, for America being small farmer first, we have crushed the dreams of so many authentic small American farmers with how we're doing this. And in many cases, I can't fault Canada because it's an opportunity and it's business. So of course you're going to do acquisition. But if the longer this takes to end prohibition in the United States, the more foreign interest will occupy this space after legalization occurs.
Oh God, yeah.
And that will look very odd to have a schedule and narcotic all of a sudden flip and be like, we're all foreign owned, like by major corporations too. It's not going to be like mom and pop foreign owned. And that is a travesty. And I don't see, unless the federal government changes its tune sooner than later, I don't see how that changes.
What about you? You mentioned Schedule 2, and I don't know if you saw my eyes like no.
Oh, no.
No, Schedule 2.
It causes a whole different set of problems where we don't understand what the legal outcome of that would be.
But if it was a Schedule 2 or a Schedule 3, do you think that, like, you know, that impact with Canada, that it would allow the United States to actually compete, even if it was a Schedule 2?
I don't think it would allow us to compete. I think the regulatory oversight might prohibit some of the interest of Canadians investing in the United States. Yeah. But even then, I think, especially because Canada is up and running, has access to banking, has access to investing, that Canadian companies are willing to play the long game on America. And okay, we'll take up acquisition of companies in the United States, have them run maybe at a deficit for a period of time.
But they can withstand it because they've got the cash reserves.
And so we'll just sit on this and slowly, I mean, especially if you're buying up actual farmland, like if you're making real acquisition of property, not just a trademark or a brand, or if you're buying up land, like you're doing okay in the long run, especially after interstate shipping or interstate commerce is allowed by the federal government, they're going to be in a great position because they don't even have to deal with tariffs then. You're already going to have means of production in the country that you want to distribute to. And I think Canada is playing the long game, and I that's opportunity. I think
did you hear about, so I was on the NCI panel, like it was that none of my panel actually got to do. One of the guys, he had told me, and I investigated it, so it's accurate, that Canadians are having trouble crossing the border from Canada
to the U.S. So the only way that we can say that the federal government
has done something
is prohibitively propping up the illegal U.S. cannabis market is by doing ridiculous levels of interrogation at times at the border. And even like a drawn out 15-minute conversation of, oh, why are you here? What's the nature of it? Business or pleasure? Oh, what states did you go to? Oh, you were in Colorado. Wow. So when you're in Colorado, you know, what'd you do? Oh, we were snowboarding. Oh, did you smoke cannabis at any time?
What?
We did once. 10-year ban.
Really?
That has occurred.
Yeah. That has occurred.
Has occurred.
Oh my God. And that's a real thing for somebody to be banned from a country.
Oh yeah.
Let's just sit on that for a moment.
To have some of the immigration attorneys that chimed in on this. So you can still apply to come to the United States with like a variance.
Yeah.
They said the rate those are granted are pretty much non-existent. So thinking about this, hey, I am a Canadian investor. I come down to the United States. I'm looking at a new facility. I'm signing the paper. I just bought it. I'm flying home. I just got told that I can't come down for 10 years. Like, that scenario isn't unrealistic. I mean, it's probably not happening as much as this might be painting it, but it is not improbable to think that that could be a scenario.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And I'm curious if it's coupled with just like the immigration
policies
that are just happening right now in the United States. I told them, I go, you know, on behalf of my country, I want to apologize. I was just like, I couldn't believe it because they were at a Canadian consulting company doing exactly what I do in California. And he goes, you know, I just like lost one of my verticals of revenue, like an entire business. And it was just, that we could have really used to help in the US. Like, that's the interesting thing. So,
well, and so, okay, in a perfect world, let's say we have federal legalization in the next, I still think it's 10 years, but we'll say in 5 years, right? Saying, and it's descheduled.
Yeah.
That person still is not allowed in the country. There's no like, hey, we're not going to give you amnesty, or we're not going to expunge your international immigration record. There is
really?
No. Yeah. I mean, you could still file for these variances or this opportunity, but I don't think they'd be granted.
Scary.
Yeah.
I was talking about expungement with Leah Maurer,
right?
the podcast before, and it was very interesting. Like, she told me that if you have an expunge, like if you had a crime, a felony, and whatever, upstate Mississippi.
Right.
I moved to Oregon. It's legal, and the felony related to cannabis. Mm-hmm. I can't get anything expunged from my record until that state, Mississippi.
Yeah, it's state by state. Yeah, there's no.
Yeah.
There's no. I moved to a place where it's permissive, so it works.
Yeah, no. That's interesting.
Yeah.
In a bad way, interesting.
Yeah. No, I would frustrating. I think would
frustrating
be.
Frustrating is the better word.
Especially if you're still looking for housing or a job or anything in the public sector or anything that requires you to disclose if you have a felony, even though you're in a state that now allows cannabis because it's adult use.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's frustrating.
Talk to us. Let's change the subject because you are the IP guy.
I'm one of the IP
guys.
And
you know,
there are IP girls too.
And there's some
very, like, very impressive IP ladies.
Right?
I'm going to say ladies, IP ladies. Yeah.
IP women.
Women.
Okay. IP
the
women.
Women of IP.
The women of IP. Yes. Okay. So you're one of the men of IP,
mm-hmm.
In the cannabis space. And so, you know, the other thing I want to talk to you about, well, does the Canadian, before we jump onto the Phoenix tiers, does the Canadian legalization impact anybody from an intellectual property standpoint? Like, is there anything that, you know, you want to tell our listeners if they were thinking about that?
I think it raises some interesting questions on the international level. Mm-hmm. So I focus on trademark issues with the majority of my practice. And for trademarks, the international harmonization of trademarks is from the Nice Agreement, which was signed into effect.
The Nice Agreement.
It was consummated on June 15th, 1957 in Nice, France.
Oh.
And it was part of the Paris Convention for the Protection of Industrial Property. So why that was important is because it created 45 classes that arguably all goods and services fall into, and they update it every, I believe, 5 years. I think old timey, it was 5 years. Now it's every 2 years. And because it's in a digital format, I think even 1 year, but they do big editing every 2 years. And so with all countries that are signatories to this treaty having the same 45 classes, like if you'll remember when California legalized and we have legal cannabis, mm-hmm. we had a hang up with the California Trademark Office because they said there's no appropriate classes for cannabis at the federal level.
Yes.
And so California proposed, hey, we'll make our own classes, which would have deharmonized the state from the federal from an international treaty. So talk about like reinventing the wheel from the ground up and totally excessive, which you can look at other countries, especially that were farther along, let's say Canada, and say, how were they using the existing 45 classes to identify the goods and services for cannabis? Mm. And so we'll go as an example, class 5, medical goods. So medical cannabis, actually, it's a medical good. We're identifying it for medicinal benefits. So we can fit it into class 5. Now, I recently was talking actually with Omar Figueroa about this, that Omar, he had a great idea. And I had thought, I'll give him full credit, but I had thought about some of this before.
Minds think alike.
Where Omar was asking me about the classification and how this is harmonized. And so I reached out to WIPO, or the World Intellectual Property Organization, who handles implementing some of the Nice Agreement. And said, hey, is there any progress on international classification codes being amended to, in the 45 classes, finding where cannabis fits? You know, is it medical for 5? Is it smoking articles? Is it, you know, do edibles actually fall under foodstuffs, or is it its own thing? Mm. And the prompt response I got was, no one's discussing this and there's no plans on amending to or creating new subclasses to fit into one of the 45. With Canada implementing and starting to export, this is actually going to become more of an issue. Also, even just with tariff codes, if you're doing an export or an import, you have to do an identification of what that good is and trying to figure out, okay, where does this fall? Okay. And so that, with Canada doing this as a G7 with intent to export and import, pushes the rest of the world to start paying attention, especially if you are a country that wants to start engaging in this kind of trade. There is a concept called customary international law. And so what that means is, before a treaty, which getting a treaty to be ratified is very labor intensive and takes time between countries. There's a lot of negotiating back and forth, takes time. But before that, certain things are still potentially transpiring. So like if you think about admiralty law and trade, way back in the old timey days with ships, before there was trade agreements actually solidified between countries, they still might have been doing trade. And the way that it was done was based around custom. And that custom then develops generally into aspects of the treaty that is. So Canada is kind of leading the pack for defining what customary international law for trade related to cannabis is, which is really exciting.
It's so exciting.
Also very unfortunate, because that could have easily been the United, well, in theory, that could have been the United States.
Yeah.
And what that means then is, other countries, especially if you're the main hub, they will kind of acquiesce to whatever your terms are to get it done. America, I think, is a little, we are a little full of ourselves. So we think we'll come to the table late and everyone will just be like, whoa,
yeah,
the American cannabis industry is here.
Yeah.
Clear, tell us what to do. We've been waiting for you.
We've been waiting for you.
Yeah. And I think there is a misunderstanding what that's going to look like. And I think that will be just another one of these things that this paper that I'm talking about, of looking back and being like, wow, we really missed some opportunities. I think this will be one of those components of falling in line. And this idea, I think America does produce the best cannabis in the world now, but it's a question of what that looks like going forward, because as more opportunity is created in Canada, the idea of losing some of our best talent to another country that has more, isn't going to persecute you.
Has free healthcare.
Right.
Has free healthcare here. I'm like, should I move to Canada right now?
And,
right?
And like, especially if you're paying your taxes and being compliant, is going to reward you with, hey, you want to become, you know, a cannabis Canadian millionaire? Let's do it. Why wouldn't you have some of the best and brightest in the industry consider moving up there?
Well, that's an interesting point. One of the investors that I worked with, you know, spent a lot of time in Toronto, and just right before California legalization, you know, actually went through the regulation, you know, did some stuff here, and then he moved to Israel. And I think that I think it's just kind of this forward thinking, like, yeah, we might have to leave this country, which sucks,
right,
if we're, you know, very patriotic and, well, and we love it, but there's more innovation. There's
going
other
back to the original things. Comment, yeah. Entrepreneur.
I yeah.
mean, if you're an entrepreneur and you're looking at what is the future trend or what is the best way to achieve my goal now,
yeah,
is it digging your heels in the sand in the United States and waiting the 5 to 10 years for legalization with whatever hiccups occur along the run? Or is it looking at other countries where it's already accessible?
Yeah.
So some of you might not know, but Simone got me invited to Prague last year to lecture, which was, thank you again for that, because that's
you're
amazing. Euro AMBC, which was, do a shameless plug for that. If anyone has a chance, go to Prague for CannaFest and the Euro AMBC. It's,
are you going this year?
Where I'm waiting. We'll wait and see. I mean, if I can,
let's get to Europe. I have it on the tour list.
Okay.
We're going.
Okay. But so at that event, there was people from all over the world, and having this experience where people were talking about how excited they were that California was about to implement go adult use, and this is amazing, and this is going to be the largest marketplace in the world for cannabis, and we've got the numbers, we've got the wealth, we've got the talent. And then I was hearing a Canadian talk about Canadian cultivated hemp that was processed in Germany with the end good being sold in Israel. And I just was like, oh. And granted, I mean, it was a CBD-focused product, But I'm like, see, that actually to me
sounds expensive.
That, and it sounds so much more interesting though, because if it's, if we just look at any of the states that are doing that, even for California having the deepest pockets, it's still a microeconomy. I can't take my good across state lines. So inevitably saturation will occur. I mean, it's a plant. We're getting very efficient at growing at it. Consumer demand doesn't necessarily match with production levels. Mm-mm. So if you don't have, I mean, Oregon is a great example of what's going on right now. Yeah. In Oregon, there's dispensaries that you can buy an eighth now for $5, which probably last year's crap. Oh yeah. Ounces for 40. And I think prices.
Ounces like, for $40.
Right, prices like that in Cal, if we had interstate commerce, the question is, would that be an accurate number? Because you could have probably sold your crop across the nation or exported it or processed it into another good and then either shelved it or exported it.
Well, and then it turns into this like fine wine, especially being in Oregon, like this craft cannabis, right? There, I mean, I remember hearing that Oregon's poised to be like between a $5 to $15 billion export market when it's federally legal.
Right.
And that's a shame we can't see that right now.
All right.
Right?
Especially if businesses are going out of business and are then being acquired by Canadians.
Yes.
Because the long game is these billions we're talking about, it's just going to go directly
to a different source.
Right. Out of the country.
Yeah.
And I do believe that, you know, finer cannabis or artisanal cannabis, whatever you want to call it, there is a future for it. But if we do a correlative, after prohibition ended for alcohol, did we see the microbreweries take off, or did we see major corporations exist for a period of time before people started saying, well, maybe we want a finer product? Because really, it seemed like it consolidated into just a handful of larger breweries and took about 50 years to all of a sudden have people be like, well, means of production, we want to do it ourselves. And really, the undernote there for me is having consumers become educated to the product that they want and having people understand consistently, going back to my statement on education, I think education is one of the most important things right now for this entire industry, but being able to explain to someone why sun-grown, organically grown cannabis, even though the THC content is only 16%, actually might be the product you want, opposed to some heavily fertilized, lots of salt, indoor, looks like a mutant crystal, 32% THC. And right now we are selling the product primarily off of numbers, because a higher number, easier to sell to a client or a consumer and say, this is obviously better.
Yeah.
That's not actually accurate. Otherwise we'd all just be drinking, you know, Everclear, and this is the best alcohol on the face of the planet. And that's not what it is. But having people understand what they want to consume, why they want to consume it, we're, you know, I don't even know if we're at square one, especially, I mean, if you're from the culture or have this cannabis experience, maybe you have some sophistication with it. But for the majority of the masses of trying to say, okay, we want new consumers, we want people who are not going to stay in the black market or maybe don't have a black market access, trying to explain to someone, well, what do you really want? Especially when they're like, I don't know what I want. I hear I need rolling papers or a pipe or something. And then this is a good time. Do you have any more Grateful Dead? You could, I don't know. Like,
but there's a huge divide, I think. You know, yes, there's a Gallup poll. 64% of Americans support cannabis legalization, but 64% of Americans are not consuming cannabis.
Oh, agreed.
Like, what is it, 20%?
I have no idea. I think I would say this. Well, I think until we have federal legalization, you're not going to get honest answers. That's the biggest problem.
I talked to Nielsen, like Nielsen data. Oh, yeah. And I was like, hey, so I was at the Product Food Expo, oh my God, 6 months ago, I think. And I talked to them because it's all about the data, right? Like, we're in 2018, like, what's up? They don't even have a division.
Right.
And so it's unfortunate because a lot of this.
Who's going to have a division?
Us.
Canada. And just even something like that of actually tracking what is a consumer base look like nationwide, being able to do an analysis based on population, based on, okay, regions of wealth and distribution. Like that will give you an honest look at what does this industry look like. We are so far off. I mean, right now what we're this is the rate of taxation, this is tax revenue that's being brought in by states.
Yeah.
Still, that's not even a clear understanding mm-hmm. of what the consumer base looks like. That's just saying, well, this is like revenue generation, yeah. but that's not a clear understanding of what the consumer looks like.
No, or even, you know, I mean, there's like Habu Health, like 80, like there's definitely groups or apps or people or companies that are trying to solve some of these problems, but right. they're not, there's no collective understanding.
Oh yeah.
Right? And like, oh, I would like to know, because my whole thing is like, how do you educate more people? Like my parents, like, you know, about my mom, like, I'm like, please. And this is perfect segue to Phoenix Tears.
Right.
I said, you know, so I talked to somebody, they're like, you know, have her try Phoenix Tears. So again, right. you know, having somebody diagnosed with a cancer, you want to make sure that they have like the best treatment possible.
Right.
And you know, that treatment for the cannabis community is right. cannabis or some derivative of such, plus maybe Western medicine.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that is the question. So Phoenix Tears has the reputation for being very successful with cancer treatment.
Is it? Okay.
And I think with that, I mean, also known, made by Rick Simpson.
I have attended, tell me everything.
Yeah.
Tell me everything about Phoenix Tears. Because I truly, she's my executive coach. She was like, hey, check out Phoenix Tears. And then I literally went to a dispensary and I was like, there they are.
Right.
And that's all I know. I mean, like, literally, that is literally all I know. But the other thing that I know, and then I'm going to give it back to you, was that the bartender was like, oh, but we can't call it Phoenix Tears. And so that's why I wanted to talk to you. I want to talk to
you. Did you explain why you can't call it Phoenix Tears?
Some issue with naming.
Okay. So, and so we're going to make some statement that there is a alleged trademark protection on that. Which, if it is, it's at the state level, because it's not, there's not going to be a federal registration on anything that has cannabinoids in it, especially extracted from cannabis. Mm. So, yeah, Rick Simpson Oil, RSO, Phoenix Tears. I have heard lectures, or a lecture by Rick Simpson. It was at the Emerald Cup a couple years ago. And hearing about the success of, from like a grassroots level, treating cancer by having high doses of extracted cannabis. I think there, personally, I believe that there's something there. Mm-hmm. Do I think we've worked up the science or the research behind it to have a foolproof, this is what it is, or hey, we shouldn't pursue other chemotherapy or something and just focus on this? I don't think that that's there yet.
Yeah.
I also think that there are some people who are well-intentioned, and I think there are some people who are not as well-intentioned who are creating RSO and then saying, hey, look, I've made this phenomenal product. And I think that that's where the room for the snake oil salesman of cannabis medicine still exists, unfortunately. I really respect the work that Rick Simpson has done. I think that as a champion and speaking very loudly that cannabis can be used for cancer treatment is something that really needs to be pushed. And especially just from a raw plant aspect, something, not something that has to necessarily be refined in a laboratory and then reduced down to a pill format.
Yeah.
Because it actually makes some healthcare more accessible to people. But do I know how it works? No. IP guy.
From the IP perspective, and that's what I wanted to really kind of understand, was kind of why they weren't able to use that name.
Was that in California or was that?
It was in Oregon.
It was in Oregon.
Maybe a state's thing.
So, well, the way that you would seek protection for it is on a state-by-state basis, registering with the state trademark office. So there is a possibility that Phoenix Tears has been registered with the state of Oregon trademark office. And there's a possibility that they were selling the product and then received a cease and desist.
I see.
So they're like, well, they actually can't call the product that anymore, which that would be my deduction of why that probably went down like that. But I don't know.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But what about even like Rick Simpson Oil, right? Like that is a household name. This is an individual.
Right.
You know, Phoenix here is now synonymous with Rick Simpson Oil.
Yes, from my understanding, they are the same product. It is just what has been called from the kind of medicinal side. I mean, with the phoenix being the bird that rises from the ash as like a form of rebirth, I think it was the idea of using these drops or using this extract to make really sick people healthy again. And I think calling it RSO or Rick Simpson, I mean, him policing that, my name was attached to.
You would want to police that bad guy, right?
Especially if people are selling an inferior product or being like, hey, check it out. Like, I heard this guy lecture once and I can make this thing now. And you're like, whoa.
No, you can't.
Right. Well, you can't. Or, I mean, you can try to. Don't sell it as something that I'm validating. And two, I'm probably a suspect because this is your first time, you're probably messing this up. I think any good that is directly attached to somebody's name, if you are going to start making it and selling it, there's a number of legal issues that you're going to run into.
Yeah.
And I don't recommend doing it. So, I mean, rebrand it as something else if you want to. Also, the other issue that I think is going on is the amount of medical claims that are being made. And we're seeing, I think, a bit more of this from hemp-derived CBD right now. And actually, there was a really good panel on this at NCIA for the CLE stuff for attorneys. And people are making some pretty bold medical claims about what does what. And if you make a medical claim that's not been verified by the FDA.
And no medical claims have been verified by the FDA of cannabis.
Right. There's no medical use. There's no medical use.
No medical use here, guys.
So, I think that's a real problem. And that's actually the consensus kind of that we walked away from that CLE with was really advise clients who look at your packaging, see if you're making statements that could be inferred as a medical claim. And then don't do it because not only are you going to have the DEA potentially coming after you still, but you're also going to have the FDA coming after you. So it's just, and I think after you get the attention of some of these federal agencies, your business is at best dead in the water at times. At worst, you're going to find some prosecution.
Yeah.
Even though we really haven't seen much of that lately, that's not to say that it's off the table.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly. Oh, troubling times.
Yeah.
Troubling but exciting times at the same time for entrepreneurs.
You know where they don't have all these issues?
Canada. I really. Oh, maybe we would go.
I would like to get up to Canada.
Yeah.
I've been having more interest. I've actually picked up a Canadian client recently too that I would like to give it a little bit more time to roll out and get established because I know they have, I mean, I'm joking in the sense that they don't have problems with this. There is issues in Canada. I know implementation, especially nationwide, is going to be hard and, you know, due to oversight and it'll be hard. But like 7 months from now, I'd like to, when it's summer, next summer would be a great time, I think, to go up to Canada and just to see what this looks like.
Yeah.
I lived in Amsterdam for a year. So I lived in a community where having cannabis be tolerated was like this thing. And I'm curious to see, and now we have it in Oregon, Washington, California. I'm curious to see what it looks like where it's not just tolerated, but it's actually federally supported. Because I haven't been around that side of this yet. Like I've been in,
you haven't been to Uruguay to see the two, what?
Strains?
It's two companies that are
involved with
it. Okay.
So not just
the two pharmacies, but
No, I have not. No, I have not made that.
Made the trek down there.
Yeah, maybe that's.
I think Canada makes a little bit more sense, a little more fun.
I think the market is just going to be a lot more developed, and it's going to look a lot more after the storefronts are implemented. What we consider as like a traditional shopping experience, or Well, I mean, granted, some of the liquor stores, from my understanding, if anyone remembers Strange Brew.
Oh, yes.
We're like, oh, Molson, case of Molson. I don't think there'll be like a conveyor belt and just throw something out from the back. But I know that the packaging is going to be far more regulated than what we've been doing anywhere in the United States. But it's going to at least have a more of a, well, when you walk out, you're like, okay, the federal government might not wrap me up.
I'm not going to get arrested. I feel like that's like, I mean, I still look and I'm like, oh my God, can I even smoke my vape pen? You know, like it's just, I'm always looking behind my back. So
the concept of, hey, I have 2 grams of cannabis in my pocket or in my bag and I'm flying somewhere and not having this can I do that? Or can I, punchline is you can't do that. That's illegal. But being like, not having to worry about that. Like that just, you know, I So I'm curious to see what this looks like. And I know Canada still has a way to go to develop the range of products that we've seen in the United States.
I've heard that they're trying to buy a lot of brands, hence that money and going
licensing opportunities. Licensing. Yeah, that and then also consolidation, that if you have a developed company, I mean, maybe your exit strategy isn't, unfortunately, with merging with a U.S. company. Maybe it's actually getting acquired by an international company right now, and then we all start drinking maple syrup for breakfast.
Oh my god, I'm excited. All right. I'm like, oh, I'm my mind's racing. I'm like, oh, I never thought about that idea. Luke, are you ready for the speed round?
Oh man, I guess so. Hold on. How many questions is it?
It's still three. And you've honestly answered a few.
Oh, man.
I know. So I've been like, oh, no. I don't want to be repetitive. I want to ask you.
You want to curveball it?
I want to curveball it.
Okay.
One. Only one question in the speed round.
Oh, wow. I thought you were maybe like come up with some like more playful ones. Like, what's your favorite cultivar? Or like, how tall are you?
Okay. Let's do a playful one. Okay. One playful one and then one serious. Like,
oh, yeah. That's great. Okay.
Your favorite cannabis product when you're in a bad mood?
When I'm in a bad mood? So why this also puts me on the spot is because if I...
You asked for it.
That's fair. If I'm in a bad mood, unfortunately, I have run out of having some, but I was gifted... some blue Skittles from Moon Made Farms, and that cultivar of cannabis was one of the nicest experiences with cannabis I've ever had in my life. That stand out to big props to Moon Made Farms. What they're doing something amazing.
Did you smoke it?
Oh yeah, smoked it
in a joint, in a bong, like
however I could. You know? I would smoke it in a bong. I would smoke it and sing a song. I just was like, this is great. And even like having it sit around in a jar for probably a few months where I slowly worked away at it every time and like showing it to people and having people be like, what is this? And I'm like, this is sun-grown, organically grown, cultivated cannabis done with a whole lot of Northern California love, and having people be like, I have not seen cannabis like this before. Really? And I'm like, yep.
Was it the color? Obviously the effects were amazing, but was it also the color?
Just the whole experience
behind
it. Yeah, it was phenomenal. I mean, the taste.
What is
the shell? It really did have a kind of candy fruit note to it. Having it cured so well that it could sit around and still hold the flavor and the smell. Because I've seen a lot of cannabis in my day, especially like seeing.
Yes, you have.
I have.
I went over to your place. You're like, do you want some cannabis? I'm like, yes. Well,
yes. Yeah. That it's what amazes me now of things that stand out is if the curing process isn't done well, how quickly you can have even something that smells good for a period of time. And granted, there could be an argument. Maybe I'm not like storing it perfectly, but this held up in like. Old tea tin, like a very large tea tin, cannabis degrades. It's like any other organic product, but when the smell goes away really quickly and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, like this still has the look, but like the terpene note or any of that is gone. That, this in this state, it was like, this is impressive.
Oh, I'm going to be trying.
Pineapple Euphoria also, they did a great job with it. That was a different gift, but yeah. Okay.
All right. I'm like, well, I'm like, oh, I want that. Okay. So
they also, as a side note, the Oscars got the first gift box.
Yeah.
Their cannabis was in the first Oscars gift box too.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm. They know what's up.
They do.
And now the movie lovers and actors do as well.
They do too. Question two.
Only question, and it's something that I'm curious. So, 5-10 years from now. Let's go for you. 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years in the future.
What's cannabis like?
Whoa. Still a plant. I don't think we're going to change. We're not changing that biology. I think it's going to look at the grassroots level, like a more normalized agricultural business, which means the margins are going to get a lot less. I hope the federal government will have come around where the American cannabis industry actually has a chance to shine and get off the ground, opposed to being driven down. If it hasn't, and we're still in a prohibition era, I see the rest of the world kicking ass and America holding on to an outdated mentality and paradigm that is just going to be punitively punishing people. I see the level of, if that's the scenario, also the saturation, there's going to be so many more states that will have adult use by that point or recreational, and the level of saturation in each one of those states will have crushed the small farmer. If it's not that and it's opened up, hopefully within 10 years, we can start to see the public having an understanding what finer cannabis looks like. I think you're going to see product range from the equivalent of, you know, this is bottom bin, and some people have their brand that they smoke, and that's just what it is, up to the like, yeah, I'm willing, and maybe even in some cases, willing to pay like $40 a gram because there is something about this that goes into what it is that makes it amazing. I think that's a hard price point to fathom right now, but I think after understanding, I mean, in the concept of wine, or which I do think Northern California is going to have a legitimate run, especially after the Appalachian project is up and running. And I think that in and of itself is going to start raising a level of education. But I'm optimistic. I'm cautiously optimistic. I don't think the thing that I really appreciate about people who participate in this community is we've gotten to this point through so much adversity and so much being told no and having lives ruined. And I think it keeps going no matter what. Mm-hmm. I don't think you shut it down. I think it might change form. I think the people who love this plant, you're going to have people who always love the plant, and I think they will keep fighting for it. I think after federal legalization would occur too, we also have more normalization. I think the stigma hopefully would be out of it. I do like the idea of a mild psychedelic being permissible throughout the entire country. I think that really shakes up some fundamental issues with our country, and maybe would breathe a level of empathy into it that has not been experienced before. But I'm optimistic. I think 10 years from now, it'll still be probably just, I mean, if we had legalization in the near future, still just be getting out of its infantile state from a legal side. I mean, it's already grown up from what it is, but having it be organized and put together, it's still going to be just learning to walk. Yeah. So.
Zimmerman, thank you for joining the show.
Simone, thank you for having me on. If you guys would like to find me, you can look for my law office online, cannabislaw.law or lawofficelsz.com. My email is lukeszimmerman@gmail.com. If you are in need of an attorney or want to speak to an attorney and you don't like the way my voice sounds, I recommend you check out the National Cannabis Bar Association. They're doing some great work. If you're interested in getting more education about cannabis and you're just kind of curious, I recommend Oaksterdam University. They're doing really great work with education. And yeah, those are, oh, and I love my mom and dad, and really, and my brother. He gave me my first mom and dad. And my parents have been immensely supportive throughout this entire experience. So I just got to give a shout out to them and my girlfriend who puts up with me talking about cannabis all the time.
I feel like for any cannabis entrepreneur,
Your boyfriend's got to be putting up a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's always good to have a supportive partner.
You have to. I agree.
So. Thank you for joining the show. You're invited back. Please come anytime, hopefully in the next few months.
I would like that.
All right. Thank you.
For listening to today's show. This is your host, Simone Simaluka-Radzins of Calogia.com. I hope that you find this episode entertaining and insightful. My goal is to educate all of you about this exciting business because knowledge is power. If you haven't already, head on over to Kalogia.com to connect with me and to meet other business leaders in the professional cannabis community. Also, if you like this, please go into iTunes and leave the Cannabis Business Minds podcast a 5-star review. See you next episode.